One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Welcome to Dr. Creepin's Dungeon. ...2020 is almost over. The new year is almost upon us. And what better way to celebrate than with five stories featuring myself and a few of my good friends. Yes, five delicious tales of terror for you this evening, in which I am accompanied by some of the finest storytellers that I know. Our first fantastic offering is The Ghoul of Valley Forge, an original story by Mr. Evan 312. And in this story, I am accompanied by Nature's Temper and GM Danielson. Now, as ever before we begin, a word of caution. These tales may contain strong language, as well as descriptions of violence and horrific acts. If that sounds like your kind of thing, then let's begin.
Bloody hell, I'm starving.
Those dreary words often echoed around the camp of desperate, bloodied souls. Some spoken aloud, others only passed in pained whispers, or simply purveying the entire atmosphere in the Valley Forge encampment. Morale was incredibly low, lower than the temperature. The flashing steel and the blood-red uniforms of the British Army were as far from everyone's mind as the ragged band of patriots languished in the cold. The biggest danger to the Continental Army did not come from without, but from within. No enlisted man, officer, nor volunteer did not know hunger. Without proper supplies, they'd taken to eating anything from roots and tree bark to cotton or sawdust, just to fill the howling voids that were their shrunken guts. What Solomon, or Sully, as his comrades called him, did not like was that the words came from Arthur, his closest friend. They were dragging a wrapped, stiff corpse of a perished fellow patriot through the surrounding forest. The look in his eyes as he sized up the body gave Sully a strange feeling in his stomach. You could not fault Arthur that much. They wore ragged uniforms, or at least what passed for uniforms, in this outfit, none of which did much to prevent the cold from seeping into their very bones. They carried muskets over their shoulders, which they'd fired in anger at the English, and both of them had killed men before. Yet, just like many of the boys in this so-called army, they could not call themselves true hardened soldiers. Even those true soldiers that remained were in the same boat as the rest. Officer or low ranking, the hunger, misery, and the cold were truly equalizers.
What's wrong, Sully?
The boy tried biting his tongue. Arthur was younger than him, not by much, but he acted even younger. He was a rash and flighty youth. Sully made sure to stick to his friend like honey to keep him out of trouble. But like Arthur's hunger made him impulsive and morbid, Sully's made him incredibly irritable and quick to anger. And this time, he gave in to the rage.
Must you always say that whenever you look at a corpse?
He barked harshly.
God damn it, Arthur. These are people.
Sully dropped the feet of the body, causing his friend to stumble under the weight as he stood to take his full height.
Christ, if you so much as think of that sort of thing again...
I'm not.
Arthur protested, the look of hunger replaced with one of shame. He nervously rubbed his hands on his threadbare sleeves, trying to warm his stiff, achingly cold fingers as best he could.
I've been hearing things in the camp. He's keeping Washington's horse under armed guard. Wonder what they're getting paid to keep their chops off that thing. I bet he'd feed a dozen men for a week. I'm long tired of boiled bark and moss.
Sully folded his arms tightly to his chest, hugging what was left of his already thin blue and red trim jacket to his pronounced ribs. Like Arthur, He'd forgotten the feeling of a full belly, forced to subsist on little more than a few scarce roots that they dug from the winter-hardened soil.
Can't enjoy the meat when you've got a noose around your neck with a bullet in your liver. Don't make me teach you what becomes of those who give in and eat human flesh.
Arthur suddenly froze in place, turning only his eyes to look onto those of his older friend. A pale look had entered the boy's rosy, frost-nipped cheeks.
Please spare me, Sally. You know I hate those kind of stories.
And so he did. Arthur was, in many ways, a fearless lad, never scared of his fellow man. He was a fierce fighter in battle for his smaller size, reminding one of a scrappy wildcat. However, Sully knew he was terrified of the old wives' tales of what stalked in the dark. More than once growing up, Arthur had slept with a lit lantern or curled up by the fire after his father or his brothers had teased him with stories. The story of the Scottish Banshee from their ancestral homeland gave the boy a particular fright in his youth. So much as hearing a female yell in the distance could set him off. Sully was not so cruel as Arthur's family and friends, so he kept those tales to himself. However, just because he did not speak them aloud did not mean that he was lacking a few yarns of his own to spin on some nights around a fire with the men. Many of the natives who he'd made contact with, such as the Lenape, had their own ghost stories tied to the land itself. These were just tales, however, stories to scare children or fools like Arthur. But Sully was no fool, and was certainly no longer a child. He knew that man only had itself to fear. After a moment, the two picked up their ends of the corpse again. They'd nearly forgotten about it, standing quietly and awkward in the cold as the snowfall became thicker around them. They did not speak now. Arthur was ashamed of himself, and Sully simply having no more to say. At least, having starved to death, this body was not very heavy. It was all they could muster the strength to shuffle about their job at little more than a snail's pace. Their hunger and the cold had cost them both a great deal of sleep. There was no proper burial place near the camp. Sickness was already ravaging the army, and the last thing anyone wanted was to bury the dead too close by. A few soldiers, who had simply withered away from hunger, were elected to be buried deep in the woods, in a small clearing Arthur had found while on patrol. By now, even in the now surprisingly thick snowfall, the two knew their way by heart, and by now the corpse seemed to be growing heavier. It had become easier to let down one's guard in the banal, dismal conditions. In these close quarters, the only thing more familiar than one's fellow soldiers and their grumbling stomachs was the daily monotony of waking up, starving, and trying to sleep. The woods around the camp had long since been harvested to the bone. The animals were virtually gone, and any roots, berries, or even carrion had been inevitably devoured. Vigilant patriot scouts made sure that no one, not even the stealthiest natives, could penetrate the defences. A shame, Sully thought to himself, because he would have traded his month's ammunition ration, perhaps even his musket, with a Lenape warrior for a scrawny rabbit or a couple of squirrels. And that's why, when Sully looked past Arthur's shoulder into the clearing, he stopped, dead in his tracks. Just ahead in the pale gloom of the falling snow was a small pile of frozen corpses. The two boys had been working much of the day to prepare them for burial. They'd been wrapped in white linen, which was rapidly blending with the forest floor as snow began to dust the rotting leaves and dirt. This made it stand out even more. Leaning over the pile of bodies was a tall figure, completely hidden under a long, cream-coloured coat with a black tri-corner hat atop their head. The coat had been well made, yet was incredibly worn and tattered, covered in dark stains and the green colour and cuffs all but faded to a washed-out drab. Sully knew that regimental colour was part of no army he knew or had ever faced. Still, he could swear that he'd seen that green and cream-coloured sort of coat somewhere before. The figure seemed to be rummaging through one of the cadavers, having discarded its burial sheet off to the side. What immediately alarmed Sully was that this man was set to be buried without any clothing or possessions, for uniforms were preserved to be given to other recruits that needed them. So, This meant the newcomer was, in fact, not merely interested in pickpocketing the dead. It was clear that this person was interested in the only earthly possession this lost soul had to offer. This revelation sickened Scully to his stomach, and rage began to boil in his blood. Dropping his end of the burden, he swung his musket off his shoulder, raised it to his shoulder, and leveled it in the stranger's direction.
"Just what do you think you're doing, friend?"
His deep, harsh voice rang across the clearing with an unmistakable echo. The stranger stopped whatever it was doing and was frozen in place.
"What are you playing at, Sully?"
Arthur, his back still to the scene, glared at Sully in confusion. With a speed that neither of the boys had ever witnessed in a living creature, the figure whipped around to meet them. Sully's weapon began to shake when he noticed the figure had not turned, but rather, only its head had somehow twisted around to look him in the face. This had not been an arcing twist or the craning of the neck, reminding Sully of one of the wooden neck hinges from one of his father's puppets. However, this action did not sicken him nearly so much as the face of the figure. If it had once been human, that had clearly long been abandoned or stripped away. The shape of its head clearly matched a human skull, but the skull was almost the sum total of what remained. Whatever flesh that remained hung in thin, desiccated, tattered strands. Bits of it even hung loose like drying lichen. The teeth were jagged, brown, broken with bits of flesh stuck between them, and the lower jaw was smeared with cold, thick, dark, congealed blood. The eye sockets looked like they'd been long empty, the sightless eyes having perhaps been stolen by carrion birds. In their place, the sockets poured forth a thin trail of what looked like white smoke or mist. The two stood and stared at each other. If what the figure was doing could even be called staring, for what felt like hours, it did not so much as waver or shift position from where it silently considered these two intruders upon its gruesome meal. Even Arthur did not so much as budge, fixated on the absence of colour in his friend's face.
"Arthur,"
Sully spoke quietly, not sure if he was trying not to be heard by the creature or to mask the quiver in his voice.
"When I give the word, throw yourself to the ground."
"What the hell is it, Sully? What the devil's behind me?"
"Damn it all. Just do as you're told. Now."
Everything seemed to happen slowly in Sully's eyes. Arthur began falling to his right-hand side. His finger, rigid with frostbite, curled tighter around the trigger of his brown vest. A cloud, like gun smoke, slowly curled from his lips as he let out a breath to steady his aim. Arthur's foot lifted some of the rotting leaves from the forest floor into the air. He could see the hammer of the flintlock begin to plunge towards the priming pin. Sparks from the flint drifted into the air like leaves in a breeze. The priming powder slowly began to spark, and then blaze brightly. Sully could swear he saw everything happen at once at that moment. And yet, in the midst of all this movement, not once did he see the figure even twitch. It stayed motionless as a stone. The musket thundered and bucked backward, filling the area with smoke and shattering the deathly silence like a hammer to a crystal glass. Solomon had positioned himself well to handle the recoil, but he did not even notice the weapon's substantial kick. He stood with bated breath, Arthur having twisted to look behind him from where he lay on the forest floor. They stared into the cloud, neither of them sure what to expect. It finally settled and cleared, revealing the figure to be sitting exactly where it had been before. Sully was at a loss for words. He was certain he'd hit it full square, right beneath the left shoulder blade. And that's when Arthur raised a trembling finger towards the stranger, pointing to the back of its coat.
"Mother of Christ. Sully, look."
Sully's aim had been true, striking the stranger right where his heart should have been, producing a clear hole. However, no blood was coming from the wound at all. This was an injury that should have been spraying that vital fluid across the forest floor or spreading in a crimson stain upon the coat. Instead, all the two could see was a black, seemingly bottomless hole, from which drifted a wisp of that strange pale smoke. The creature, for it was already clear this was inhuman, was entirely unperturbed.
By God, what are you?
Was all Solomon could bring himself to say. With the hushed utterance of these words, the thing leaped into action, moving like a mere blur. Sonny's gut instinct kicked in. Dropping his now useless musket, he threw himself on top of Arthur in a gallant, brotherly action. Draping his larger frame over that of the boy, he braced for the clasp of a cold, dead hand around his neck. Yet, it did not come. When Sully dared to crane his neck and see, the figure had instead taken the corpse by the ankles with its rotting hands. Quickly lugging it out of the clearing, it had already reached the tree line. The corpse had taken two boys to carry, yet this monster moved with the strength of three large, well-fed men at once. In its hurry to leave, the corner of its great coat had snagged on a protruding root. However, seemingly not noticing, just ignoring the inconvenience, it merely continued along, and the coat was discarded on the ground. This gave Sully a full view of the horror he had just encountered before it disappeared with its grisly prize forever. It had a human shape, walking on a pair of legs with two arms, but it more closely resembled a bedraggled scarecrow. Almost all of its skin and muscle were absent, as if this were a corpse picked clean by vultures, yet miraculously continued to walk afterward. It was almost pathetic to look upon, as if a stiff wind could carry it away. The few shriveled tendons that were left seemed barely sufficient to hold the bones together, never mind provide it with the unearthly strength, speed, and grace with which it moved. There was undoubtedly something incredibly dark and unholy that drove this wretch past the point of death, if it had ever been alive in the first place. All the two boys could do was stare at each other in absolute shock of what they had just witnessed. They were uncertain about what they'd actually seen. They were not sure of when the alerted Patriot sentries had come running to the scene of the gunshot, demanding to know what had happened. They were at a loss what they would say to their commanding officers back in the camp. But one thought was foremost on the two young men's minds. Their appetites and shriveled stomachs had been thoroughly vanquished from the forefront of their minds.
Now, as a doctor of the darker arts, there's not much more in life I find pleasure in than the cut of a fine blade. Ah, the feeling of a smooth shave with a high-quality razor. Oh, there really is nothing like the comfort of a close shave with a product that you truly trust. Which is why I turn to Harry's and the fine work of two young men, Jeff and Andy. Two ordinary young gentlemen who were fed up with the price of other razors and started Harry's to fix the world of shaving. And fix it they did. So, what might you expect from a Harry's trial set? Well, you'll get a weighted, ergonomic handle, five precision-engineered blades with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade, rich, lathering shave gel, and a travel blade cover. So get started shaving with Harry's today by claiming your trial set for £3.95. You can support my podcast and get your trial set delivered to you, including a razor handle, five blade cartridge, foaming shave gel, and travel blade cover by going to harrys.com/creep right now. Again, that's harrys.com/creep. Our second story this evening is Skin and Bone, by Nerdcore Neil. This features the vocal talents of Madame Raven, Swamp Dweller, and Tales to Chill the Bone.
I don't like her. She's weird,
complains Travis, arms crossed and pacing back and forth.
Look, bud,
answers Trevor, anxiously watching out of the living room window.
I have to go to this meeting, or I could lose my job. Kim and I have been dating for a long time now. I really like her and wouldn't trust anyone else to watch you while I'm gone. It's just for tonight, and this will give you a chance to really get to know her. Who knows? By the time I get back to you, you two might be best friends.
doubt it,
Travis replied. Trevor sighs and turns to his son.
Travis, ever since your mom died, I didn't think I'd ever find another woman that I could feel this way about. But Kim is different. I really like her, and I think that we might actually get married someday, if everything keeps as good as it has been. I get it. You miss your mom, and I do too. But I've got to move on. I'm not asking you to like Kim, just because I do. I just want you to give her a chance. Please. For me.
This makes Travis feel a little guilty. He hadn't really gotten to know her all that well, but Kim really freaked him out. She was a very tall, very skinny woman that kind of reminded him of Momo. She had long black hair and a huge pair of eyes that looked like they could pop out of her head if she tried. Her face was constantly covered in heavy amounts of makeup, and she drenched herself in strong perfume to the point that he could literally smell her coming. To her credit, the few times that Travis had actually met Kim in person, she was actually very sweet and friendly to him, but her appearance made him extremely uncomfortable. Rolling his eyes, arms still crossed, Travis replies,
"Fine."
Not too much later, a black car pulls into the driveway and a tall figure wearing a long fur coat steps out. As she comes to the door and rings the bell, Travis is immediately hit in the face with the strong smell of her perfume.
"Well,"
he coughs.
"It's definitely her."
"Be nice,"
replies Trevor in a stern voice. Trevor opens the door, and Travis can't help but shudder as he sees the image of this alien-looking person standing in the doorway, her huge eyes staring gleefully at his father, and then quickly to him.
"Hey, bud,"
Kim squeaks in a high-pitched voice.
"Are you having a fun night?"
Her smile is stretched wide, showing off her way too white teeth.
"Oh, yeah,"
answers Travis, unenthusiastically.
"Super fun."
For a second, it kind of looks to Travis that her left eye twitches just the tiniest bit after he says that. Travis swallows hard. Trevor invites Kim inside and she gives him a huge extended kiss. Travis has to keep himself from gagging at the sight of his father making out with this strange-looking woman. Eventually, Trevor leaves for his trip, meaning that Travis was now alone with Kim, and his dread began to rise quickly. At first, things are relatively uneventful. Travis stays in his room playing video games, and Kim sits in the living room watching TV, periodically checking Facebook on her phone. Eventually, it was time for dinner, which, to Travis's delight, Kim just ordered a large pizza. They sat at the dinner table, and Travis was shocked at just how much pizza Kim had eaten. He often wondered if she ate at all, but she easily put away half the pizza within 10 minutes. Travis wanted to ask her how she could eat so much and be so skinny, but he was afraid to offend her again.
"Hey, Kim?"
he starts.
"Yeah, bud?"
she replies, chewing on the latest slice of pizza she'd started on.
"I was just wondering, how it is that, well..."
"You want to know why I'm so skinny, right?"
Travis nearly chokes on his own slice.
Yeah, actually.
"Well, I have an extremely high metabolism, which means that my body burns calories a lot faster than other people. I actually eat quite a lot, believe it or not. But no matter how much I eat, my body just stays the way it is."
"Oh, okay."
Travis feels really bad now. He feels like an ass for thinking she looked scary because of how skinny she was, and it wasn't even anything she could control.
"Sorry."
"Don't worry about it, bud,"
she says, finishing the last of her meal.
"I know I look funny, but it is what it is."
As the night progressed, Kim and Travis actually started to bond pretty quickly. They played video games together, and then watched a scary movie. Eventually, it was bedtime, and after brushing his teeth, Kim bid him goodnight and he crawled into his bed. After about half an hour, he realizes that he needs to pee and makes his way to the bathroom. After he does his business, he notices that Dad's bedroom light is on. Realizing that it must be Kim, an idea comes to him. Now, Travis is a 12-year-old boy, and dirty thoughts as well as genuine curiosity began to come to him. He wonders if she's changing, or maybe even just completely naked. Maybe he could get a quick peek. He'd never seen a real naked lady in real life before, and he especially wondered what Kim looked like without clothes on. Sneaking close to the door, he slowly turns the knob. It's not locked, to his relief. Even slower, he opens the door a crack, just enough to peek inside. What he sees is not what he was expecting. Kim was standing in front of his mom's old vanity, but something was very wrong. Sitting on the table was what at first looked to be a mask, but soon became clear to be something sinister. It was Kim's face. Not just the face. It was basically her entire head minus the skull. Slowly and shakily, Travis turns his attention to Kim's head, which was literally a pale white skull. Travis didn't even care that she stood there completely nude like he'd hoped. He was too transfixed on the freaking skull with two large eyes. Travis then watches as she begins to remove her skin as though she were taking off one-piece pajamas. She reaches inside of it and pulls out what appears to be a large sack. She takes it to the small private bathroom, and Travis can hear her dumping something into the toilet and then flush it. She comes back, folds the skin and places it in a large black box that was laying on the floor next to the video. Finally, she pops out her left eye and places it in a small bowl of water on the table. And then she does the same with the right eye. She turns off the light and then slowly shambles her way over to Trevor's bed. Travis slowly closes the door and silently freaks out. Not knowing what to do, he slowly walks back to his room and climbs into bed. He does not sleep this night. The next morning, Kim gets Travis out of bed for breakfast. They sit at the table, eating the scrambled eggs that Kim had prepared before getting him up. No words are spoken at first, until Kim breaks the silence.
"I know you saw me last night,"
she says flatly.
I don't know what you're talking about,
responds Travis, refusing to look at her.
Stop,
she says sternly, freezing Travis in place.
Just stop. I know you saw my face. My real face. I know you watched me. I thought it was my imagination until this morning. You're acting like you've seen a monster. And I need you to understand.
You are a monster,
Travis yells, cutting her off, immediately regretting that decision. Kim's face becomes sad.
Look, bud, there's things in this world that you wouldn't understand. Yes, there are monsters in the world. Real monsters that would have killed you in your bag the second they suspected you saw them in their true form. But I didn't. Because I'm not a monster. Am I human? No, not really. Do I mean you harm? No, I don't. But you need to understand that beings like me are not understood by regular people. So my existence has to stay between us. I don't want to hurt you. I don't want to scare you. But I will protect myself and others like me.
Terrified, yet understanding at the same time, Travis agrees to not speak of what he saw, to anyone, ever. Later that day, Trevor returns, and Travis nearly knocks him over as he runs over and hugs him.
Wow, bud.
Trevor laughs.
I've missed you too. Did you two get along?
Travis looks over to Kim, who stares at him with a somewhat worried look on her face.
Yeah,
he answers, genuinely smiling.
She's actually pretty cool. We had pizza, played some games, and watched movies. I like her a lot.
He looks over to Kim, who is smiling brightly. Kim gives Trevor a big kiss and gives Travis an even bigger hug.
Thank you,
she whispers in his ear. Travis whispers back.
You can trust me, I am trusting you, too.
And with that, Kim leaves, and Travis waves goodbye. With a newfound respect for Kim, and new questions about what else is out there, he walks over to his dad to ask how his trip was.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
In our third story this evening, I'm joined by Musy's Modern Dreadfuls for a story called My Friend Was Raised to Know the Exact Date of Her Death by Hyper Obscura. I only knew Michelle for a month, but it was truly a month to remember. I first met her when she was carving out my high school bully's eye with a butter knife, and we were more or less inseparable after that. She was a few years older than me, so of course I fell instantly in love, but I knew deep down we were destined for friendship and little else. Well, I knew this deep down because she made it clear that she was going to die in roughly a month.
"Can't love a dead chick,"
she'd say. At first I thought it was just a clever way to avoid the awkwardness of turning me down, but at some point I became close to believing her. There's just something about her, something extremely free, careless and unconfined, refreshingly brave and outspoken and honest. When I met her, I was going through the most depressing period of my life. I was constantly bullied and belittled at school. My younger twin sisters were both hospitalized, each needing a transplant to survive. Jenna needed a heart, Chloe needed kidneys, and my parents had their hands full covering the medical expenses. I think we all, in our own ways, were on the verge of just giving up, of just letting go. I was saved by Michelle, I've no doubt about it. If she hadn't shown up when Brett was beating the shit out of me, I would have killed myself that day. I was just so sick of it. Sick of the beating, sick of the abuse, sick of being alone. But Michelle came out of nowhere, threw him into the wall, knocked his nose halfway up his brain, and proceeded to dig out his left eye with the aforementioned cutlery. He never touched me again. You'd think she'd get into trouble after doing something like that, but it was never reported. Brett claimed it had been an accident, that he'd crashed with his moped. I think he feared that Michelle would kill him if he said otherwise, and I for one have no doubt that she would have. That's just who she was. Michelle never went to school. She said it was because she knew she was going to die.
Why bother with bullshit like school then?
She was all about enjoying life to the fullest. Kicking assholes in the face. Fucking over people who fucked over others. She wanted to leave this world a better place than she'd found it. And by her logic, this was done exclusively by ridding it of shitbags one way or another. "How do you know you're gonna die?" I asked her once.
"My parents tell me,"
she said.
"Every day. And they're good for their word."
Well, she wouldn't explain it in detail. Just that she was raised knowing the exact date and time of her death. Down to the very second. And that it was meant to be. And that's what they told her. In death, her life would have meaning. At first I didn't think much of it. You know, she was a crazy girl and she always said weird stuff like that. I was kind of banking on it all being some bizarre joke or something. But when the month drew to a close, I was getting really worried it might all be true. I'd grown too attached to her. Every minute I wasn't at school or the hospital was spent with her, and the thought of losing her, my only friend, made me horribly depressed. That last week I was really on edge. The twins were in bad shape and my parents were spending every waking minute at the hospital. They'd yet to find any donor matches and time was running out. It felt like my time was running out too. The dark thoughts were returning and I started imagining how I'd kill myself should Michelle ever leave me. I found it strange that she'd never invited me home. I mean, friends do that, right? invite each other over. Well, she'd been to our house several times. She even crashed on the couch a few times, and we'd often watch movies there, raid my parents' liquor cabinet, get wasted, and generally just have fun. But I'd never been to her house. Not once. I didn't even know where she lived. So one night I just decided to follow her. What was there to lose, really? Maybe I could get some answers from her parents or something. Some way to explain why she was so convinced she was dying. Maybe they'd lied to her. Some sort of cult. A way to form her beliefs into accepting the unacceptable. A way to control her. I stalked her for 30 minutes, lurking in the shadows as she paced down the streets. When she headed to the outskirts, I started getting worried, and when she took the narrow trail through the forest, I was almost having a full-on panic attack. Where the hell was she heading? As far as I knew, there weren't any houses for miles. About halfway into the forest, I suddenly lost her. It was like she'd vanished without a trace. I walked back and forth, up and down, but there was just no sign of her at all. Eventually, I had to give up and return home, my mind growing even darker. I remember the last day like it was yesterday. Every minute of it. Crisp and clear and vivid in my mind. Every scent, every sound, every muscle moving on her perfect face, all those smiles and kind words, everything. Well, the last day came and went, but I didn't know it was the last day. I mean, if I'd known, I would have told her how much I cared for her, how much she meant to me, how much I owed her my life and sanity. Without her, I wouldn't be alive, but, well, I didn't know, and I never told her. I hope she somehow realized it, that she could see it in my eyes and actions every day, but I can never be sure. She just acted so normal, you know. She was Michelle that day, too. Same carefree spirit, the same wild, devil-may-care attitude. We spent the afternoon smoking weed, watching silly cartoons, laughing and just enjoying each other's company. But when she left, I knew something was up. I don't know how. I guess there was some detail, some little thing that alarmed me. But having replayed and analyzed that day over and over in my mind, I can't think of anything. Nothing. But I knew. So I followed her again. This time I stayed closer, always having her in my sights, always knowing exactly where she was. She was walking considerably slower that night. Almost like she knew I was behind her. Almost like she wanted me to follow her. The air was cold and crisp, and whenever autumn draws close, I can step outside, take a deep breath, and relive the exact moment when she suddenly turned on her heels to face me.
"This is it,"
she said.
"This is the day I die."
She walked over to me and handed me an envelope. It was light, but there was definitely something in it. A letter, perhaps.
"You will need this."
She stroked my hair gently.
"When the time comes, you'll know what to do with it."
"I don't understand," I said. "Please, let's just leave. Let's just get out of here." She smiled and kissed me on the cheek. Oh, if I concentrate real hard, I can still conjure up the smell of her perfume.
"This is goodbye,"
she murmured softly.
"But you will come to understand that it was always meant to be."
I reached out to hug her when they emerged from the darkness. Two tall figures clad in dark robes, an old man and an elderly woman, their milky white hair flowing gently in the breeze. They had this solemn expression on their faces, the kind you'd see in funerals, an expression of acceptance to sorrow and despair because, well, it's just a part of life. Michelle pushed me away forcefully, and by the time I'd regained my balance, it was already too late. Her throat had been slit from either side of her neck. A perfect cross, left to right, right to left. Blood was squirting out, colouring the dull brown of the roadside a deep shade of crimson. The robed couple swiftly stepped back into the shadows, leaving me desperately clutching the lifeless body of Michelle, screaming my lungs out, wailing like an animal into the cold night. The paramedics came 10 minutes later. I have no idea who called them. Anonymous, they later told me. Well, she had no ID on her, so they asked me a bunch of questions. I didn't know the answer to any of them. She was Michelle. That's all I knew. Her name was Michelle. She was my best friend, and she was the best person I'd ever met. They let me ride the ambulance to the hospital, but they quickly pronounced her dead. She'd lost too much blood, they told me. And it wasn't my fault. There wasn't anything I could have done. This didn't offer me much comfort. I was devastated. Totally broken. The dark thoughts resurfacing once again. This time with more power than ever before. "What's that in your hand?" one of the paramedics asked. "Does that belong to Michelle?" I glanced at the envelope. It was completely drenched in blood, much like me. And then it suddenly hit me. I don't know what it was, but it was like she told me.
"When the time comes, you'll know exactly what to do with it."
And so without thinking, I just handed it over to him. He sort of held it up like he'd somehow see through it if he got a better angle of it, before he gently opened it. "Well, I'll be damned," he said. Well, I'm better now. I still have problems understanding what happened, but I am better. I've come to terms with it. The fact that everything happened just the way it was supposed to happen, and it has shaped me. Shaped my life into what I am today. Michelle didn't just save me. She saved my entire family. Every aspect of my life. And I guess you're wondering what was in that envelope. Maybe you'd figured it out. Maybe not. It was a donor card. And as it turned out, she was a perfect match for my twin sisters.
"Can't love a dead chick,"
she said. And that's the only thing she was ever wrong about.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at kosai.org.
Our penultimate tale of terror is... "There's a Church in the Middle of Nowhere, and You Should Never Confess Your Sins There," by Blair Daniels. This once again features the vocal talents of Musey's Modern Dreadfuls.
"Forgive me, Father, for I have sinned." My voice shook as I spoke. "It has been 2 years since my last confession."
"Go on, my daughter. Tell me your sins."
The priest's voice was low, quiet, unfamiliar. That was by design. I'd driven 20 miles from my apartment to a church in the middle of the woods. It was easier that way. I took in a deep breath. But only a squeak came out. "Get it over with," I told myself. "Just say it." "Father, I'm guilty of gossip, jealousy." The venial sins came out first, as they always did. It was almost easy to confess them. "And..." My heart beat faster. My hands grew sweaty, slipping against the wood. I stared at the divider between us. White cloth made of mesh. The priest's dark outline on the other side. "I did something terrible a year ago." Silence. The kneeler bit into my legs. The stuffy heat pressed into me. He has to accept my confession. Has to absolve me of my sins, right? As long as I am genuinely heartily sorry, which I am. The mesh swam before my eyes. The shadow behind it shifted. I hit someone. Once I'd lanced the wound, it all came bursting out of me. I knew I had too much to drink. I knew I shouldn't have been driving, but I did. I sat behind that wheel, started my car, and...
Who was it, my daughter?
His voice was surprisingly calm. No scream, no gasp, no groan of horror. I wondered briefly how many confessions he'd heard exactly like this. Confessions past the normal realm of jealousy, anger, infidelity, and theft. How many murders had been confessed within these walls? I don't know. That's the worst part, Father. I just kept driving. I didn't even stop. My voice cracked. Tears burned my eyes. I didn't check to see if they were still alive. Didn't call an ambulance. Didn't...
I understand, my daughter.
It was out. I told him everything. The tears rolled down my cheeks as I sobbed. Gaining composure, I said in a shaky voice, "Those are my sins, Father, and I am so sorry." Silence. It stretched into seconds, then minutes. The hot air pressed into me. My knees ached. Finally, I spoke. "Aren't you going to absolve me, Father?" His voice came from the other side, loud and clear.
"Well, I'm afraid I can't do that."
"What? Why not?"
"Because I am not a priest."
Horror thundered through me. "What do you mean you're not a priest?" No reply. "Who is he? A police officer? A man waiting to do something terrible to me? Somebody..." I lifted myself up from the kneeler, legs shaking, and peered around the divider. I froze. No one was there. "What the hell?" I whispered. "Wherever you are, I'm going to..."
"Kill me?"
The voice came from behind me. I reeled around. A shadow flickered across the mesh, now on the other side, where I'd just been kneeling. I immediately ran to the other side, but the kneeler was empty. "Where are you?" I yelled.
"Everywhere."
The voice echoed back. In a panic, I ran to the door, grabbed the knob, turned it as hard as I could. Locked. "Let me out!" I screamed. The doorknob slipped and slid under my sweaty fingers. "Please let me out!"
"No."
The voice was low and raspy, right in my ear. I whipped around. Nothing there. Just that vague silhouette behind the cloth mesh. It was standing now, as if at any second it would dart out and grab me. "Help me!" I screamed, banging my fist against the door. Please, help!
You know what you did.
The voice seemed to come from every direction, echoing, reverberating, growing louder and louder, in overlapping whispers.
You deserve this.
I threw my entire body against the door. It shook underneath me. Thump, thump. I reeled back and threw my body against it again.
Nothing can save you. You are beyond redemption. Worthless.
No! I screamed, throwing my body against the door again. But I was weaker this time. The guilt pulled me down like a weight of lead. No, please!
Even if you get out that door, I will follow you. Wherever you go, I will be there.
The voice was dark and low. The shadow was pressed up against the mesh now. It looked wrong. Misshapen, twisted, different. Like something trying to look human. No! I screamed and flung my body against the door. It flew open. Coughing, gasping, bluttering.
Are you all right?
A voice asked. A priest stood over me. He extended a hand. Slowly, I climbed to my feet. I glanced back at the confessional. The room was empty. The shadow was gone. I wanted to run. Out the door, into the parking lot, into my car. I wanted to drive and drive until I was miles away from this place. Miles away from what I did. But no matter where I went, it would follow me. It would flicker across my rearview mirror on the open road. It would live in the mist on the hotel bathroom mirror. It would lie in the spare bed, roiling and twisting under the sheets as I lay wide awake.
I will follow you anywhere.
Raspy whispers filled my ears. A shadow flit at the corner of my vision, but I forced myself to look away, forced myself not to listen. I locked eyes with the priest. Father, I need to make a confession.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Now it's time to round off proceedings for this evening with a story called 20 Days in Sasha by Chase Lamb. This is an all-star cast featuring the talents of GM Danielson, Don't Turn Around, Mr. Davis, Unit 522, and Dead Man Talking's Forest of Fear.
If you can hear this, this is Chase Lamb. We need help right away. There's something in the woods. It's coming to the door. Oh God, the footsteps are outside the door. Oh my God, it's almost here.
End of transmission. Hello, this is Chase Lamb, along with the four other idiots I have with me. Brandon, Mitch, Gordon, and Mike. We met in college while we were studying to be game designers, but we figured out that wasn't for any of us. Instead, we decided to explore the unknown and unexplained. We are what you call paranormal explorers. We travel to places that can't be explained and try to bring it into the light for an answer. So today we're heading to a town called Sasha. We got a lead on this from one of those Facebook posts from people going on about, oh, how the scary stuff doesn't exist. The thing that got our attention, though, was when we tried to find it on Google or any mapping system, we weren't able to locate it. Luckily, our local library has some information on it, as well as a couple of old newspaper articles on the town. Well, according to old books and newspapers that we've read so far, the town has no sign of life. Well, none for nearly 80 years. Nobody can explain why, but it's rumored that anybody that attempts to stay there for 20 days simply disappears. And on top of it all, they're never found again. These apparent warnings given to us raised our curiosity. After doing a lot of research and database searches, we were able to find out where Sasha's location is. Day 1. Since, apparently, nobody has stayed here for 20 days, and we need proof, I brought my journal so I could keep notes. Mitch also brought along his video camera, so you'll be able to watch clips of us at the same time. We're now 20 minutes away from Sasha, and I'm looking forward. Get out of here. Leave now. A ghostly figure of myself appeared and showed me dead.
Wake up, Chase. Wake up.
Gordon shook me violently.
Wait, what happened?
I said, dazed and confused.
You started to drift off, and it looked like you were falling asleep or passing out.
Yeah, I'm fine, Gordon. Don't worry about it. I didn't want to tell him what I'd just seen because, well, he might think I've been trying to chicken out. And I highly doubt they'd believe me anyway. I just decided to shake the whole thing off as a small dream or some hallucination. So it had been, well, a while since I'd gotten any sleep. Yeah. So Mitch stopped the car, looked at us with a playful look.
Welcome to Sasha.
Brandon took out the camera and started to film the surroundings around us. Well, they were right about it looking abandoned. It looked like nobody had lived here in years. God, the grass was almost 7 feet tall. There were cornfields with dead brown pieces of corn all around them. We recorded the area and found nothing except for an old wooden house that was destroyed. Since it's likely no one lives there, we decided that, well, this is where we would set up camp. Day 2. Oh, we spent most of the night trimming the hedges, but couldn't do much. Seems like we were trying to trim down metal and steel all in one. Well, today, the plans for us consist of fixing up the house and making it livable again. We all looked around it and found nothing ghostly or any signs that people had even lived here. All we were able to see were tons of dust or a bunch of spiderwebs, like the place was trying to tell us that, oh, we shouldn't be here. Ah, well, enough of that. I'm going to help the rest of the group get the repairs done. I'll be writing back in my journal in a couple of hours. Well, it took us 4 hours, but we were able to settle in the house. We all celebrated with a cold beer as we were able to get the electricity into the house, which almost seemed impossible to do. The next thing's dinner. Mitch brought out the camcorder and said in a playful voice,
"All right, people. For our wait until this ancient evil crap gets us, what do you want?"
He pulled out a selection of burgers in his left hand, and he brought out a T-bone steak on the right. Well, we all pointed to the left, and we had the burgers. After dinner, we're all exhausted. So this is where I'm going to put the journal down and get some shut-eye. I'll be sure to write tomorrow. You all have a good night. Day 4. I feel like a complete fool. Forgot to write in my journal about the third day. I apologize for that. There's nothing I can do about it now. We're all bored from sitting around and just exploring the house, so we decided to have some fun. Took the camcorder to go out and explore the woods. As expected, we found nothing of talent and fortune. All we saw were trees and, well, insects. However, one thing that stuck out and provided mystery was, how was there a fresh dead deer out here? There'd been no sign of life for 80 years. So how could something be out here? Well, we were all trying to think of possible explanations. Animals get into it. Dying of starvation, natural causes. Eventually we all calmed down and decided to claim that the wildlife had taken it. The rest of the day mostly consisted of us playing cards at the table. Just relaxing until at 8:30 p.m. We heard a banging at the door. Grabbed our gear and went outside, and we were shocked when we saw the deer that was not even dead 4 hours ago was gone. It's gone. All of it. I mean, the body, the tracks, even the blood. It was almost as if something was coming to clean up a mistake it had made doing its work. Well, that night, none of us got any sleep. Day 5. No, I don't claim to believe in the paranormal activity or, well, things like that, but all of last night I heard these unexplainable noises. It sounded like small children. Well, every time we went outside, the noise would stop. It was almost as if something knew we were coming to see what it was, and in our state of confusion, we heard a loud, howling screech. When we went outside to investigate the noise, nothing was there. God, this place keeps on getting creepier and creepier. Day 7. Sorry, I haven't ridden in a couple of days. I hit my head and I was in and out of it yesterday. We don't know what caused me to fall. Well, I was thinking there's maybe some weird mold or something in the air. Instead, we found something inexplainable. It was a journal with a key slot. The shape of it looked like it was a diary, but of course, there was no key to be found. Well, instead of bashing it open and seeing what was inside, we picked the lock, trying not to damage the contents. In the meantime, Gordon decided what we were doing was boring. Yeah, he thought it would be fun if we went fishing instead. We all got our rod and reels. We went fishing for 2 hours. Well, to the surprise of everybody, turns out there were fish that were living in the yellow ponds. At the end of our trip, we decided to head back and eat the fish, since they looked edible. Oh, we were all excited to head back to the house. But that feeling was slowly turning to panic and fear. Oh, the house looked a total wreck. It looked like a tornado had come in and thrown all our stuff around. Our cameras were distorted, along with all our belongings scattered on the floor. We were frustrated and confused. But I noticed something that nobody else had. The place where the journal lay is torn into pieces. Something was looking for this journal. Well, I'd hidden it in one of the closets and locked it behind me, not telling anyone. But the journal is gone. Someone was here. I don't think it was any of us. Well, we gathered in the room, staring at one another in silence.
Okay, who pulled off this prank?
Gordon said with fury in his voice. None of us replied. All we could do was look and hope someone would confess and say it was a prank. That didn't happen. Well, we just decided that it would be best to clean up and forget about this mess. But that wouldn't be easy. After we'd finished cleaning the house and putting everything back where it was, we all went to sleep. Within the hour, the other four were all snoring. I couldn't sleep. Not after what had happened today. I tossed and turned, hearing the sound of paper crumpling. I heard it again and again. It sounded like it was coming from under my bed. So I lifted my bed to see a perfectly intact piece of paper. Day 8. I decided not to tell the others about the paper. I think they suspect me for the big mess that was made. We all went downstairs for breakfast and decided we were going to explore the cornfield later. It was different than the first time I'd seen it. Just as we were putting our plates away, there was a giant thump at the door. It sounded like something had charged at it. We all jumped out of our chairs in shock. Brandon went into a frenzy, reaching in his bag and taking out a gun. And then he ran off. Brandon, stop. What are you doing? We ran after him to stop him. We followed his footsteps, which led to the cornfield. We had to find him before he did something stupid, or ended up hurting himself. We followed the steps for what felt like an hour. In our hunt, we came across something strange. We found this weird footstep in the dirt. It looked like something was walking with 5 feet, except every footprint was different, almost like every print was a different animal. As we inspected it, we heard a blood-curdling scream to the left of us. It was Brandon. We ran to him, pushing off every piece of corn that came in our way. We got to him and saw him in this fetal position, shaking as blood ran down his body. Some animal had bitten him on the right shoulder. We grabbed him and brought him back into the house. Thankfully, this time, it wasn't torn to shreds. But Brandon's shoulder was bleeding, and he was starting to have convulsions. Grabbing a cloth from the bathroom, we made a tourniquet to stop the bleeding. And luckily, it worked. Oh, I hadn't noticed, but in all of the commotion, that paper was somehow on the ground. A drop of blood dripped from Brandon's shoulder, hitting the page. Only for words to show up. Day 10. I didn't write this yesterday, since we spent the entire day trying to decode the paper. It would only show words with Brandon's blood. We tried ours, but, well, nothing worked. We gathered his blood, and, deciphering 4 lines of the page, after our efforts, we figured out the 4 lines and what it said.
"This is Baden Marcus. We were very stupid to come here. The tracks at night are from the animal. We have never seen anything like this. If you see..."
And it ends there. Everyone was convinced this animal, the paper mentioned, was the one that left the weird foot track in the dirt. I sat at the door for what seemed like hours and came up with a plan. Yeah, I would sit at the side of the door, and when it would appear, I'd take a picture of it. I stood there for an hour, ready to give up, before I heard noises coming from the side of the house. Taking the camera, I saw its face before it ran off into the cornfield. Like a wolf with a scar running from its forehead to its eye. I was looking at the footage to see it up close and to show the guys. When I saw the film, I saw nothing of the animal. I slowed the camera, looking at it frame by frame. All it showed was me running to the back of the house and looking at nothing. Frustrated, I went to bed. Day 11. Ever since Brandon got bit by the animal, he's been acting strange. Not in a medical way, but he started speaking French randomly, and his emotions turned into anger and depression. Now, I'm not a doctor, but this isn't the Brandon I know. Plus, he doesn't even know French. After we helped Brandon get out of bed, we gave him an aspirin and put some peroxide on the bite. Everything was working out. We put a band-aid on to keep anything from getting into the bite. After that, we were all bored and decided to go fishing. We put up a camcorder so if anything could get into the house, we would catch it on film. After a walk to the dock, we got our equipment out and went to get started. I put the rod out and, within the first 5 minutes, I caught a fish on the line. Excited, we pulled it to the surface. And the feeling turned into dust as the reality of our catch came into view. It was a human skull. Well, I thought after seeing this, our next thought would be getting the hell out of this crazy place. That's what sane people would do. But our stubbornness got to us. We voted together that we were going to stay. After this little voting stage, Mike got thirsty, so he went back to the house to get some water. 30 minutes passed and he hadn't yet come back. We all started to worry that something had happened to him, so we went back to the house to check on him. When we got there, there was nothing there besides his shirt and the 5 claw-like footprints. Day 13. Yesterday, the thoughts of my journal didn't even come to my head. The day consisted of trying to find our lost friend. We looked in the plains, in the house, and the cornfields. There was no sign of him. And to make things worse, the footprints were gone. After the search, we couldn't find him or even see any signs that he was there. We got our phones out to get a signal to call 911, but no one could get one. The only way to finding Mike was the paper. In a panicked effort, we applied pressure on Brandon's now-healed wound to get blood out and show the final words of the page. Nothing came out, though. In a rage of fury, Mitch threw a book at the wall, breaking a board and revealing a dog skull. Well, we were in shock. Went to examine it. It was indeed a dog skull, and by the looks of it, it'd been there for a very long time. What in the hell is a dog skull doing here? There's got to be more to this place than just a scary legend. In a curious effort, we took our shovels and dug around the back and front yard to find anything to help us. And what we found was nothing what we would have ever expected. My God, there were bodies. Lots of bodies, not just human bodies. The more we dug, the more bodies we saw. There were so many animals. Dogs, cats, and humans. Whatever was here was making it look like a signal to get out, because something did not want us here. Day 14. Oh, this is going to be a terse entry. We're getting ready to leave and to go to the police and talk about all of this. We have to report what we found in the yard and the story about Mike and reporting him missing. Again, we heard something last night when we were investigating. We saw one of the footprints. Yeah, this is it. We're packing and we're leaving first thing tomorrow. Day 15. We're almost done packing. We're keeping guard at the door with Mitch's gun. If the creature comes to get us, we'll be ready this time. Brandon needs to go to the hospital. His eyes have been getting more bloodshot every hour, and he randomly jerks his body. The rest of the things were packed, and I started carrying Brandon out to the car. God, it's time to get out of this place. God, just when I thought things couldn't get any worse. Oh, well, I was wrong. Our car was destroyed. It looked as if someone had whacked it with a baseball bat for 200 times. The windows are bashed in. The engine looked like someone had dropped it, a giant boulder on it. We had nowhere to go, and no one to contact. And the nearest town is 105 miles away. We were screwed. We're going to die here. The only thing that we could do is hope and pray. Our only hope was the paper. We went to get it, hoping that it may contain some clue, some way to get out of here. Anything to get out of this hellhole. Well, we got the paper ready to squirt Brandon's blood all over the pages, not caring how we escaped this place. And when we grabbed the paper, I was shocked to see it was readable. All of the other times we'd seen it, it was blank. It turned out it was a journal, similar to the one that I was writing, except a man named Bernard Jenkins had written it. It explains all the events that had happened to us in the journal, and was a warning. He warns us of a creature that shouldn't even have been born here in this world. It's made this its home, and it will kill anyone that invades its property. Inside is also a video recording from him being questioned by the police. Day 16. Here's the police tape recording we found, taped to the journal. Well, we pulled out our video camera and recorded what came next.
Bernard, are you okay?
The officer said in a very calm voice.
Am I safe?
Bernard asks in a very edgy voice.
Yes, it can't hurt you. but we need to ask you a couple of questions about what happened in Sasha.
He paused.
7 of you went in. 1 comes out 20 days later. Doesn't look good for you.
The officer says. Bernard replies in an earth-shattering voice.
It wasn't me. It was that thing. I saw it. It bit all of my friends and killed my Allison. My sweet Allison.
He puts his hands on his head while shaking violently.
She became one of those things. The creature's bloodshot eyes. They came for me, but I got away. But every time I close my eyes, I see it. You don't know what it's like. I can't live. I can't sleep. Every second is just me wondering if I can live an extra minute before it comes to get me.
The officer seems to be not paying any attention.
The thing that bit us. It had brown fur, 5 legs, and we couldn't kill it. We tried shooting it, but it wouldn't die.
Bernard starts to shake violently.
It wouldn't die! It would not die!
The officer grabs Bernard and says,
"Calm down. You're safe now."
His voice is reassuring, but the calm is broken. Suddenly, Bernard yells again.
Oh my God! It's right behind you!
Camera flips over. 2 gunshots fired, and then it ends. The end says that Bernard and the officer were never found in the room where the shots had been fired. All they found were the 2 bullets. Oh, it's terrifying even to think that the same thing that hunted Bernard is now hunting us. God, what should we do? It's 105 miles away from a town, and whatever is trying to kill us is driving us to insanity. Is this what it wants? For us to turn on each other, one by one? Day 70. All night we heard the growling. Every second I heard it. Wasn't until the littlest sight of sunlight came out that the growling stopped. We were granted with a morning present that had made us all sick to our stomach. At the doorstep was Mike's body. Destroyed and everything. It looked like he'd been ripped in half by a chainsaw. Midge and I couldn't even look at the body. We took a blanket, covered him, and put him into one of the holes we'd previously dug. We promised we'd find the thing that did this to him and burn it, and we will kill that creature and deliver this evil away from this world. We took all of our weapon-related items ready to hunt. But we were interrupted by another of Brandon's seizures. We thought of what Bernard had said. One of those things. God, was Brandon turning into something else that wasn't human? Well, I loaded my gun and pointed it at Brandon. I almost pulled the trigger, but was interrupted by Gordon.
Dude, what the hell are you doing?
He tackled me to the ground, yelling those words. I took a deep breath and replied slowly. What Brandon said about people turning. We should kill him before he turns. Now, Gordon had the most disgusting expression that I'd ever seen him make. He slapped me in the face and told me never to think that again. After 15 minutes, things calmed down with Brandon. We finished preparing our weapons. At 11 p.m., we grabbed our guns and were about to walk out the front door. But Brandon was gone. He'd run out the front door and left the house, and there was a trail of blood to follow. We instantly thought the worst had happened to him. We heard the sounds of movement somewhere out in the field, though whenever we shone our lights out on the movements, there was nothing there. The blood trail was coming to an end. And then we found Brandon. He was dead. We left his body, swearing we'd get a proper burial for him after we'd killed the creature. We gave up on our search finding the beast at night. We decided to try and find it during the daylight instead. We arrived back at the house and gathered our things for the night. We went to bed and, within a moment of laying down, we were all fast asleep. Day 18. At 3 a.m., a door randomly burst open, and what we saw instantly woke us. It was the creature. It had the head of a bear, followed by scars covering the right side of its face. I immediately grabbed one of the guns and shot at it. Dodged my bullet and ran back to the front door. It must have considered me a threat. Before it ran, Gordon swung a baseball bat and hit it in the ribs. We saw it run off with blood coming from its mouth. We were both excited and happy that it could be hurt, because if it bleeds, it can be killed. No noises were made that night, nor did it show emotion, but you could tell by its movements that it was hurt. It ran, and we chased it outside, but before we could leave, we heard the shatter of glass breaking behind us. It was Brandon. We didn't know if he was alive at all. His eyes were completely bloodshot, and foam ran down from his mouth. A thought popped in my head, going back to the things Bernard had said, how it turned people into those creatures. Brandon was now one of those things. He ran at us, not like how an average person should. We heard his bones crack. It made me want to throw up, but I was able to hold it back. Gordon and I ran to the basement as fast as we could, and we boarded up the door. Brandon was still outside, smashing the door and trying to break it. We were frantically looking for something to help us in any way. We spotted an old ham radio. I set it up. With deep breaths, I said, "If anyone can hear this, this is Chase Lamb. We need help right now. We're in grave danger. If anyone can hear us, we're in Sasha and need help right away." Just then, the smashing of the door stopped. We heard a howl come from outside. It must have been the creature calling its flock back to its home. After hours of waiting in the basement and listening for any sign of living things in the house, we came out. Exhausted and in pain, we needed sleep. We decided that someone would keep guard and we would switch every 3 hours. Well, hope this is a better day than the one we've had in the past. Day 20. It's now the afternoon. We've made a plan to escape Sasha. We don't know how this didn't come across our minds before. At the dock, when we first found the skull, there was a boat. Well, it was in decay and looked like it hadn't been used in years. It was our only choice. It was hard abandoning everyone, but Gordon and I just had to. Well, Mitch was missing. Brandon had turned into one of those things. Mike was dead. Well, we gathered the gear, ready to make the fastest run of our lives to the boat. We checked the inside of the house in case Brandon was hiding, or the creature was waiting for us. We looked out the windows and found that everything was the same outside. Well, the saying, looks can be deceiving, couldn't be further from the truth. It was quiet. No footprints were there, and nothing new was outside. We knew it was watching somewhere. I mean, it has to be. Remember, it's the 20th day. Nobody survives 20 days. So we got the bags and all the guns we could and opened the door, running out as fast as we could. Nothing was out of the ordinary, but this didn't even get us to the thought of slowing down. As if I just jinxed myself, the creature came from the cornfield, screaming and hissing as loud as it could. Looking at its fanged teeth and its wolf-like structure only made me run faster as it ran at us with extraordinary speed. Gordon must have noticed that he was almost near us because I saw him pull the pistol and shoot off 3 rounds. One hit the creature and we heard it gasp out in desperate pain. I yelled at Gordon to keep shooting, but when he did, the gun jammed. There was no time to fix it, so he threw it and we just kept on running. Halfway to the boat. Oh, we're almost there. We can make it out of here. We were running when we suddenly saw it in front of us. It was Brandon, or what used to be Brandon. Blood was spilling from his mouth, and his eyes were completely red. He caught us off guard and tackled Gordon to the ground. I went to help, but Gordon just yelled, saying,
"Run and save yourself."
Well, I had no choice but to listen to my friend and watch as both the creature and Brandon attacked him. I was finally at the dock. And to my surprise, I found Mitch working on the boat at a frantic pace. Mitch, what are you doing here? Where were you? He cut me off.
I'll tell you everything later. We just need to escape this place.
We jumped on the boat and revved the engine to try and get it to work. But it wouldn't budge. The creature was now in eyesight, and along with it was Gordon and Brandon right behind it. The beast and the rest of them ran at us, and we were about 20 feet away from each other before the engine started. It started. Oh, it started. We drove off slowly into the distance to see the creature and my two friends screaming and yelling at us. A tear came down my cheek as reality set in that I'd lost almost everything I'd had in my life. I turned to my right to talk to Mitch, but he wasn't there. Instead of sitting in the passenger seat, he was staring back at the town. When I asked if he was all right and turned him around, I saw his eyes were bloodshot. He bit me right before I pushed him off the boat into the propellers, where they broke and sliced him to pieces. And so, I write this, not knowing how long before I turn. But if, for some reason, you get the mad idea that we did and are reading this, run. Run now, never look back. I feel the change is coming. Don't make the same mistake we made. Just turn back and save yourself.
Well, I hope you enjoyed tonight's little festival of fun with some of my good friends, some of the best storytellers out there. That's enough of 2020. Time to move on to a new year. And I do so hope you'll join me again in 2021. Until then, very, very sweet dreams and bye-bye.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.
Legends, the greatest social casino experience has arrived at Legends.com. With thousands of the best free-to-play casino-style games, chances to earn millions of bonus coins and win real money. Legends is revolutionizing the Vegas experience wherever you are. If you love winning, then you'll love playing at Legends.com. Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Visit Legends.com for more information. Legends with a Z.com is legendary fun.